I think I've worked that out, I said. Suppose it wasn't Diana Cooper who was driving the car. Mary O'Brien didn't actually see her face, and as far as we know, she was only ever identified because of the registration number. Mrs. Cooper went to the police. She turned herself in. She could have done that to protect Damien. He was the one behind the wheel. The more I thought about it, the more it made sense. He was her son. He was getting famous. Maybe he was drunk or on cocaine or something. She knew it would ruin his career if he was arrested, so she took the rap. And she made up that stuff about forgetting her glasses to get herself off the hook. You have no evidence for that. As a matter of fact, I do. I played my ace card. When you were talking to Raymond Clunes, he mentioned that when he had lunch with her the day she was killed, he saw her as she came out of the tube station. She waved to me across the road, that's what he said. So, if she could see him across the road, that means her eyesight was perfectly good. She made up the whole thing. Hawthorne treated me to a rare smile. It flickered across his face, but was gone in an instant.
I see you've been paying attention, he said.
I've been listening, I said warily.
The trouble is, she might have been wearing her glasses when she came out of the station, Hawthorne went on.
He seemed genuinely sad, as if it pained him demolishing my theory.
Clunes didn't say anything about that. And if she wasn't the one who was driving, why does she never get behind the wheel of a car again? Why does she move out? She seems to have been pretty upset by something she didn't do.
She might have been just as upset that Damien had done it, and she was an accessory. Somehow, Alan Godwin found out the truth, and that was why he killed both of them. They were in it together. The train had picked up speed. The buildings of East London were giving way to a little more greenery and some open spaces.
I don't buy your theory, Hawthorne said. The police would have checked her eyesight after the accident, and anyway, there's all sorts of things you're forgetting.
Like what? Hawthorne shrugged, as if he didn't want to continue the conversation. But then, perhaps, he took pity on me.
What was Diana Cooper's frame of mind when she went to the undertaker? He asked. And what was the first thing she saw when she went there?
You tell me.
I don't need to, mate. It was in that rubbish first chapter you showed me. But I think you'll find that's what matters most. Everything turns on it.
What was the first thing that Diana Cooper saw when she went into the funeral parlour? I tried to put myself in her shoes, stepping off the bus, walking down the pavement. Obviously it was the name, Cornwallis and Sons, written not once, but twice. Or maybe she saw the clock, which had stopped at 1 minute to midnight. What could that possibly have to do with anything? There had been a book made out of marble in the window, the sort of thing you'd see in any undertaker's. And what of her frame of mind? Hawthorne had told me that Mrs. Cooper knew she was going to die. Somebody had threatened her, but she hadn't gone to the police. Why not? Suddenly, I was angry. For God's sake, Hawthorne, I said. You're dragging me halfway across England to the coast. You could at least tell me what we're meant to be doing.
I already told you. We're seeing the judge. Then we're going to the scene of the accident.
So you do think it's relevant? He smiled. I could see his face reflected in the glass, with the countryside rushing past on the other side.
When you're paid by the day, everything is relevant, he said.
He went back to his book and didn't speak again. Nigel Weston, the judge who had presided over the case of the Crown versus Diana Cooper, but who had favoured the second of the two, lived in the very centre of Canterbury, with a view of the cathedral on one side and St. Augustine's College on the other. It was as if, having worked in law all his life, he had chosen to surround himself with history and religion. Ancient walls, spires, missionaries on bicycles. His house was square, solid, with everything in proportion, looking out over a green. It was a comfortable place in a comfortable city, with a man now enjoying a comfortable life. Hawthorne had arranged to meet him at 11 o'clock, and Weston was waiting for us at the door as I paid the taxi. He looked more like a musician than a retired barrister. A conductor, perhaps. Slender and fragile, with long fingers, silver hair, inquisitive eyes. He was in his 70s, shrinking with age, disappearing into the heavy-knit cardigan and corduroys that he was wearing. He had slippers, not shoes. His eyes were sunken, gazing out at us intently over rigid cheekbones like two clerks behind a bench. "Do come in. I hope you had a good journey. Train's not playing up." I wondered why he was so genial. I assumed that Hawthorne hadn't told him why we were here. We followed him into a hallway with thick carpets, antique furniture, expensive art. I recognised an Eric Gill drawing and a watercolour by Eric Revilius, both originals. He showed us into a small living room with views over the green. There was a fire burning. It was real, too. Coffee and biscuits had already been laid out on the table.
"I am very pleased to meet you, Mr. Hawthorne,"
he began after we had sat down.
"You have quite a reputation. That business with the Russian ambassador, the Bezrukov case, excellent police work."
"He was found not guilty," Hawthorne reminded him.
"He had a brilliant defence, and the jury, in my view, was misdirected.
There was no question that he was guilty of the crimes.
Will you have some coffee?"
I hadn't expected Hawthorne to be known to the judge, and wondered if the Bezrukov case had happened before or after he had left the force. The very name sounded unlikely. Would the Met have ever had dealings with the Russian embassy? The judge poured for all three of us. I examined the room, which was dominated by a miniature grand piano, a Bluthner, with half a dozen photographs in expensive frames arranged on the lid. Four of these showed Weston with another man. In one of them, they were dressed in Hawaiian shirts and shorts, arm in arm. I had no doubt that Hawthorne would have already noticed them too.
"So what brings you to Canterbury?"
Weston asked.
"I'm investigating a double murder," Hawthorne explained. "Diana Cooper and her son."
"Yes, I read about that. A horrible business. You're advising the Metropolitan Police?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very wise of them not to let you go. You believe that the traffic accident in Deal and the very unfortunate death of the young child connect in some way with the murders?"
"I'm ruling nothing out, sir."
"Indeed. Well, emotions do run very high in these sorts of cases. And I note that we are approaching the 10th anniversary of the actual event, so I would imagine it is a distinct possibility. That said, I'm sure you will have had full access to the court reports, so I don't see quite how I can help you."
He still spoke like a judge. No word left his lips before it had been carefully evaluated.
"It's always useful to speak to the actual people involved."
"I agree.
It's the difference between testimony and written evidence. Have you seen the family, the Godwins?"
"Yes, sir."
"I feel very sorry for them. I felt sorry for them at the time and said so. They felt that justice had not been done, but I'm sure I don't need to tell you this, Mr. Hawthorne. The views of the victim's family, particularly in a case such as this, cannot be taken into consideration."
"I understand."
Just then the door opened, and a second man looked in. I recognised him from the photographs. He was short, quite stocky, and about 10 years younger than Weston, holding a supermarket bag for life. "I'm just going out," he said. "Is there anything you want?"
"I left the list in the kitchen."
"I've got it. I just wondered if there was anything you forgot."
"We need some more dishwasher tablets."
"They're on the list."
"I don't think there's anything else."
"I'll see you." The man disappeared again.
"That's Colin,"
Weston said. It was a great pity that Colin had chosen this moment to introduce himself. I glanced at Hawthorne. Nothing in his manner had changed, but I was aware of a certain frisson in the room that had not been there before, and I'm sure that the interruption influenced the interview and the direction it now took.
"The newspapers weren't too happy with your verdict," Hawthorne said, and I saw a hint of malevolence dancing in his eyes.
Weston gave him a thin smile.
"It was never my habit to look at the newspapers," he said. "What made them happy or unhappy had nothing to do with the facts."
"The facts were that she killed an 8-year-old child, crippled his brother, and walked away with a slap on the wrist."
The smile became even thinner.
"It was the task of the prosecution to prove death by dangerous driving under Section 2A of the Road Traffic Act of 1988,
Weston said.
"This they failed to do. And with good reason. Mrs. Cooper did not ignore the rules of the road, and did nothing that created a significant risk. There were no drugs or alcohol involved. Do I need to continue?" She had no intention to kill anyone.
She wasn't wearing her glasses.
Hawthorne glanced at me, warning me not to interrupt.
I agree that was unfortunate. But you should be aware, Mr. Hawthorne, that the incident took place in 2001. Since then, the law has been tightened on this particular point, and I think that's entirely correct. But for what it's worth, if I were trying the case today, even given the new guidelines, I think I might well come to the same conclusion.
Why is that?
I refer you to the transcripts. As the defence successfully demonstrated, the responsibility did not lie exclusively with the accused. The two children ran into the road. They had seen an ice cream shop on the other side. The nanny briefly lost control of them. She was in no way to blame, but even if Mrs. Cooper had been wearing her spectacles, it is quite possible she would still have been unable to stop in time.
Is that why you told the jury to let her off?
Weston looked pained. He took a moment before answering.
I did no such thing, and quite frankly, I find your use of language a little offensive. As a matter of fact, it would have been quite within my jurisprudence to advise the jury not to convict, and they, in turn, could have ignored me. I will agree that my summing up did lean generally in Mrs. Cooper's favour, but again, you must consider the facts. We're talking about a very respectable person with no criminal record. She'd committed no obvious offence given the law of the time. As tragic as it was for the family of the two children, a custodial sentence would have been completely inappropriate.
Hawthorne leant forward, and once again I was reminded of the jungle animal going in for the kill.
You knew her.
Three simple words, and yet they were followed by a silence that was almost physical, that slammed shut like a mortuary door. It was the moment everything changed, when Nigel Weston knew there was danger in the room. I was aware of the crackling of the fire and felt the heat of it against my face.
I'm sorry.
Weston said.
I'm just interested that you knew her. I wonder if that had any bearing on the case.
You're mistaken. I didn't know her.
Hawthorne looked puzzled.
You were a close friend of Raymond Clunes, he said.
I don't think...
Raymond Clunes, the theatre producer. Not a name you'd forget, I'd have thought. Also, he made you a lot of money.
Weston was keeping his composure with difficulty.
I do know Raymond Clunes perfectly well. He is a social and a business connection.
You invested in a show?
I invested in two shows, as a matter of fact, La Cage aux Folles and The Importance of Being Earnest.
Damien Cooper starred in the second one of those. Did you meet him and his mother at the first night party?
No.
But you discussed the case with Clunes.
Who told you that?
He did.
Weston had had enough.
How dare you sit here in my home and make these accusations, he said.
He hadn't raised his voice, but he was furious. His hand had tightened around the end of his armchair. I could see the veins bulging out beneath the skin.
I had a very distant, tangential connection with Mrs. Cooper. Anyone with any intelligence would see that every judge in this country might find themselves in the same position, and, according to your logic, would be forced to recuse themselves. I'm sure you've heard of 6 degrees of separation. Anyone in the court could join the dots between themselves and the accused. As it happens, I did go to a party following the first night of The Importance of Being Earnest, but if Damien Cooper or his mother were there, I did not see them, and I did not speak to them.
And Mrs. Cooper didn't ask Raymond Clunes to approach you at the time of the trial?
Why would she have done that?
To persuade you to see things from her point of view. You might have listened to him because you were both... What's the word I'm looking for?
You tell me.
Angels. You and Mrs. Cooper were both investing in his plays.
I've had enough of this.
Weston got to his feet.
I agreed to see you because I thought I could help, and I also knew by reputation. Instead, you come here with all... sorts of unpleasant insinuations, and I can see absolutely no point in continuing with this discussion.
But Hawthorne hadn't quite finished.
You know that Raymond Clunes is going to jail?
I've asked you to leave,
Weston thundered. So we did.
Back out in the street,
and on our way to the station, I turned on him. "What exactly did you hope to gain by that?" I asked. Hawthorne didn't seem at all put out. He lit a cigarette.
"Just test in the water."
"Do you really think there was some sort of gay conspiracy going on? That Raymond Clunes and Nigel Weston would have got together, as he'd put it, because they happened to have the same sexual orientation? Because if that's what you think, I have to be honest with you. I think you've got a problem."
"Maybe I've got lots of problems," Hawthorne replied.
He was walking more quickly, not looking at me.
"But I didn't mention anything about sex. I was talking about money. Why have we come all this way? Because we want to know about the accident, the connection between Diana Cooper and the Godwins. Justice Nigel Weston was part of that connection, and that was all I was exploring."
"You think he had something to do with her murder?"
"Everyone we meet had something to do with her murder. That's how murder works. You can die in bed, you can die of cancer, you can die of old age, but when someone slashes you to pieces or strangles you, there's a pattern, a network, and that's what we're trying to work out."
He shook his head.
"I don't know. Maybe you're not right for this, Tony. It's a shame I couldn't go with one of the other writers."
"What?" I was horrified. "What are you talking about?"
"You heard me.
You spoke to other writers?"
"Of course, mate. They turned me down."
18. Deal. I didn't speak to Hawthorne on the train to Deal. We sat across from each other, on opposite sides of the aisle, and there was more distance between us than there had ever been. Hawthorne read his book, resolutely turning the dog-eared pages. I stared morosely out of the window, thinking about what he had said. Perhaps I was wrong to be offended, and I did wonder which other writers he'd approached, but by the time we arrived, I'd managed to put the whole thing out of my head. It didn't matter how it had come to me. This was my book, and it just made me all the more determined to make sure that I was the one in control. I'd never visited Deal before, but had always wanted to. I read all the Hornblower books when I was at school, and this is where they began. It's the setting of the third James Bond novel, Moonraker. Hugo Drax plans to destroy London with a newfangled V-2 rocket fired from his headquarters nearby. And it's one of the settings in my very favourite novel, Bleak House. The hero, Richard Carstone, is garrisoned there. In fact, I've always had a fondness for seaside towns, particularly out of season when the streets are empty and the sky is grey and drizzling. At the time when I was reading Hornblower, my parents would often go to the south of France, but they would send me, my sister and my nanny, to Instow in Devonshire, and the whole language of the British seaside has stayed with me. I love the sand dunes, the slot machines, the piers, the seagulls, the peppermint rock with the name printed, impossibly, all the way through. I have a hankering for the cafes and the tea shops, old ladies pouring muddy tea out of pots, slabs of millionaire shortbread, shops that sell fishing nets, windbreaks and novelty hats. I suppose it's the age I am. These days, everyone leaps on a plane when they want a cheap holiday. But that's also part of the charm of all those little towns along the coast. The fact that they've been left behind. Deal seemed to be surprisingly charmless as we came out of the station and walked down the main street with the seagulls screaming at us from the rooftops. It was May, but the season had yet to kick off and the weather was utterly miserable. I wondered what it must be like to live here, trapped in the triangle formed by the massive Sainsbury's and the inevitable Poundland and Iceland supermarkets. A drink at the Sir Norman Wisdom pub, dinner at the Loon Hin Chinese restaurant, and then on to the Ocean Rooms nightclub on bar, entrance next to the co-op. We came to the sea, as cold and uninviting as only the English Channel can be. Deal has a pier, but it is one of the most depressing in the world, an empty stretch of concrete, brutalist in style, lacking any entertainments whatsoever. No penny arcades, no trampolines, no carousels. I wondered why the Godwins had sent their children here. Surely there must have been somewhere more fun. But gradually, the little town won me over. It had that peculiar defiance of all coastal resorts, that sense of being quite literally outside the mainstream, on the edge. Many of the houses and villas fronting the sea were brightly painted and had overflowing window boxes. The pebble beach, sloping down to the water, stretched into the distance, with a wide promenade and dozens of benches. There were flower beds, lawns and parkland, old fishing boats leaning on their side, dogs running, seagulls hovering. We came to a miniature castle, and I began to see that in the sunshine, Deal might provide a host of adventures. I was being too cynical. I needed to look at it with a child's eye. We did not visit the accident site to begin with. Hawthorne wanted to see where Diana Cooper had been living, and so when we reached the sea, we turned right, towards the neighbouring village of Walmer. We still weren't talking to each other, but as we continued along the seafront, we passed an old antique shop, and Hawthorne suddenly stopped and looked in the window. There wasn't much there. A ship's compass, a globe, a sewing machine, some mouldering books and pictures. But, as if to break the silence, he pointed and said,
"That's a Fokker Wolf FW-190.
He was looking at a German fighter plane with three black crosses, and the figure one on the fuselage suspended on a thread. There was a tiny pilot just visible in the cockpit. It was from one of those plastic kits, Revell, Matchbox or Airfix, that children used to assemble, although to be fair it had been so well made that I doubted that a child had been involved.
"It's a single-seat, single-engine fighter developed in the 30s, he went on. "The Luftwaffe used it throughout the war. It was their favourite aircraft."
It was quite a different Hawthorne who was speaking, and I understood that he had given me this scrap of information as a peace offering, to make up for what he had told me on the train. It wasn't the history of the Fokker Wolf that interested me. It was the fact that Hawthorne had shown it to be one of his enthusiasms. He had actually revealed two things about himself in the space of one day. There was the reading group, and there was this. It didn't add up to a character I particularly understood, but it was a start, and I was grateful. We talked for another 15 minutes, and at some stage Deal turned into Walmer, and we arrived at Stonor House, which was where Diana Cooper had lived until the accident that had forced her to move. It was sandwiched between two roads, Liverpool Road at the back and the beach at the front, a private drive connecting them, with ornate metal gates at each end. From the little that I knew about Diana Cooper, I would have said the house had suited her very well. Certainly I could imagine her living here. It was pale blue, solid, well maintained, with two floors, several chimneys, and a garage. A pair of stone lions stood guard in front of the door. It was surrounded by topiary that had been precisely clipped, and semi-tropical plants equally disciplined in narrow beds. The whole place was walled off so that it was both prominent and private. Of course, some of these particulars could have been installed by the new owners, but I got the feeling that it was more likely they had inherited it the way it was. "Are we going to ring the bell?" I asked. We were standing on the Liverpool Road side. As far as I could see, there was nobody at home.
"No, there's no need."
He took a key out of his pocket, and I saw the name of the house on the tag dangling underneath it. For a moment I was puzzled. Then I realised. He must have taken it from Diana Cooper's kitchen, although I wasn't sure when. I didn't think the police would have allowed him to remove evidence, so they were probably unaware it even existed. The key was solid and chunky, not a Yale. I saw now that it couldn't have fitted the front door. It was much more likely to open the gate. Hawthorne tried it a couple of times, then shook his head.
"Not this one."
We walked around to the other side of the house and tried the gate that opened onto the beach, but the key didn't fit that one either.
"That's a pity," Hawthorne muttered.
"Why did she hold on to the key?" I asked.
"That's what I wanted to find out."
He looked around him, and I thought we were going to walk back to Deal, but then he noticed a second gate on the other side of the road. Stonor House had a quite separate private garden right next to the beach. Smiling to himself, he crossed the road and tried the key a third time. This time, it turned. We entered a small square area with bushes on all four sides. It wasn't exactly a garden, more a courtyard with miniature yew trees and rose beds surrounding a pretty marble fountain and two wooden benches that faced each other. The ground was paved with York stone. The effect was theatrical, like a scene from a children's story. even as we walked up to the fountain, which was dry and hadn't been used for some time, I felt a sense of sadness and had a good idea what we were going to find. And there it was, carved onto the stone shelf of the fountain. Lawrence Cooper, 3rd of April 1946, 22nd of October 1999. To sleep, perchance to dream. Her husband, I said.
Yes. He died of cancer, and she built this place as a memorial to him. She couldn't stay in the house, but she always knew she'd want to come back. So she kept the key.
She must have loved him very much, I said. He nodded. Just for once, we were equally uncomfortable standing there.
Let's get out of here, he said.
The accident that had changed Diana Cooper's life had taken place close to the Royal Hotel in the centre of Deal. The Royal was the handsome Georgian building where Mary O'Brien had been staying with Jeremy and Timothy Godwin. The three of them had only been minutes from tea and bed when the car ran them down. I remembered what Mary had told us. The children had come off the beach, which was behind us, with the pebbles sloping down. The pier was nearby. The road was wider here than at any other point in Deal, and subsequently the cars travelled faster, sweeping down from King Street, which formed a junction over to the right. There was a shop selling Deal Rock and an entertainment arcade on the corner. This was the way Diana Cooper had come. In front of me, there were more shops in a short parade, a pub, a hotel, a chemist. It advertised itself as Pier Pharmacy. Finally, next to it, stood the ice cream shop, with a front made up entirely of plate glass windows and a bright striped canopy. It was all too easy to see how it had happened. The car coming round the corner, moving quickly to avoid the cross traffic. The two children choosing exactly that moment to slip away from their nanny, running across the pavement and then into the road in their hurry to reach the ice cream shop in front of them. Nigel Weston might have been right. Even with glasses, Diana Cooper would have been hard-pressed to stop in time. The accident had taken place at exactly this time of the year, almost to the day. The promenade would have been just as empty, the late afternoon light just beginning to dim. "Where do we start?" I asked. Hawthorne nodded.
"The ice cream shop."
We could see it was open. We crossed the road and went in. It was called Gale's Ice Cream, and it was a cheerful place with plastic chairs and a formica floor. The ice cream it sold was homemade, stored in a dozen different tubs in a freezer that had seen better days. The cones were stacked up against the window and looked as if they might have been there a while. Gale's also sold fizzy drinks, chocolate crisps, and ready-mixed bags of sweets, another seaside staple. A menu on the wall advertised eggs, bacon, sausage, mushrooms and chips, the Big Deal fry-up. I had wondered how long it would be before I saw the obvious pun based on the town's name. Just two of the tables were occupied. An elderly couple sat at one. Two young mothers with pushchairs and babies were at the other. We went up to the counter, where a large, smiling woman in her 50s, wearing a dress and an apron that matched the canopy, was waiting to serve. "What can I get you?" she asked.
"I'm hoping you can help me," Hawthorne said. "I'm with the police."
"Oh?"
"I'm making inquiries about the accident that happened here a while ago. The two children who were hit by the car."
"That was 10 years ago."
"Diana Cooper, the woman who was driving, she died. You didn't read about that?"
"I may have read something, but I don't see..."
"Fresh evidence may have come to light." Hawthorne was keen to shut down the conversation.
"Oh?"
She looked at us nervously, in a way that made me wonder if she had something to hide.
"I'm afraid I can't tell you very much about it," she said.
"Were you here?"
"I'm Gail Harcourt. This is my shop. And I was here the day it happened. Makes me feel sick when I remember those poor little children. All they wanted was an ice cream, and that was why they ran across the road, but they were wasting their time. We weren't open."
"At the beginning of June, why was that?"
She pointed at the ceiling. "We had a burst pipe. It completely flooded the place, ruined the stock and put out the electrics. We weren't insured either, of course. Well, you should have seen the premium. It nearly ruined us." She sighed. "If only they'd stopped to look. They just ran across the road at the worst possible moment.
I heard the accident. I didn't see it. I went out into the street and saw them both lying there. The nanny didn't know what to do. She was in shock. But then she was young herself, only in her 20s. I turned my head and then I saw the car. It had stopped just the other side of the pier. It stayed there a minute and then it drove off.
Did you see the driver? I asked. I got a dark look from Hawthorne, but I didn't care.
Only the back of her head.
So it could have been anyone.
Where was that woman? They put her on trial.
She turned back to Hawthorne.
I don't know how anyone could do that. Drive away from the scene of the accident. And those two little children lying there. What a bitch. She wasn't wearing her glasses, you know. But who gets behind the wheel of a car when they can't see? She should have been locked up for life. And that judge, the one who let her walk free, he should have been sacked. It's disgusting. There's no justice anymore.
I was quite taken aback by her vehemence. For a moment, she seemed almost monstrous.
I've never felt the same here since,
she continued.
It's taken all the pleasure out of running this business, but there's nothing else I can do.
Two more customers came in, and she hitched up her apron strings, preparing for business.
You should talk to Mr. Traverton, next door. He was there. He saw much more than me.
She brushed us aside, and suddenly the plump, smiling lady was back, everyone's favourite aunt.
Yes, dear. What would you like?
I remember it like it was yesterday. 4:15. It had been a beautiful day, not like today. Perfect sunshine, and warm enough to go paddling in the sea. I'd just been serving a customer. He was the one everyone was interested in later on, the mystery man. He left the shop about 5 seconds before it happened, and it was thanks to him that I heard it so clearly. You see, he activated the entrance door. I actually heard the car hitting those two children. It was a horrible sound. You wouldn't have thought it would be so loud. I knew at once it was going to be bad. I grabbed my mobile phone and went straight out. There was nobody else in the shop, by the way, except Miss Presley, who used to work in Natural Remedies, but she's married now. I don't think she lives in Deal. I made sure she stayed behind before I left. We have a lot of drugs and medicines here, and we're not allowed to leave the premises unguarded, even in exceptional circumstances such as these. Pier Pharmacy was one of those strange, old-fashioned shops that seemed very much at home in a British seaside resort. As we'd gone in, the door had folded open automatically to reveal a rack with a dozen varieties of hot water bottle. Nearby, a collection of brightly coloured scarves hung forlornly on a wire display. The shop seemed to sell a little bit of everything. Looking around, I saw stuffed toys, jam, chocolate bars, cereal, toilet paper, and dog leads. It was like one of those crazy memory games I used to play with my children. There was a corner with stationery and terrible birthday cards, the sort you might find in a garage. A whole aisle was given over to herbal remedies. By far the biggest area was at the back of the shop, which contained the actual pharmacy. Deal might have more than its fair share of old-age pensioners, but no matter what diseases their later years might bring, I was sure they would find a remedy here. The staff wore white coats. They had hundreds of different packets, foils, and bottles within reach. We were talking to one of them, Graham Traverton, the owner and manager, a man in his 50s, bald and ruddy-cheeked, with an off-putting gap between his two front teeth. He was keen to talk to us, and I was astonished at his grasp of detail. He seemed to have a perfect memory of everything that had happened that day, to the extent that I wondered if he wasn't making some of it up. But then again, he had been interviewed before, by the police and by journalists. He'd had plenty of opportunities to rehearse his story. And I suppose, when something terrible happens, you do tend to hang on to the details that surround it. I went out through that door and almost bumped into the customer who was standing on the pavement, Traverton continued. I went straight up to him. What happened? I asked. He didn't tell me. He didn't say anything. I tell you, I can still see all of it. Every day, when I go home. It's like a photograph engraved on my mind. The two children were in the road. Both of them dressed in blue shorts and short-sleeved shirts. I knew that one of them had to be dead just from the way he was lying there, with his arms and legs all wrong. His eyes were shut, and he wasn't moving. The nanny, her name was Mary O'Brien, was kneeling beside the other little boy. She was obviously shocked. She was like a ghost. As I stood there, she looked up at me, and for a minute, she was staring right into my eyes. It was like she was pleading with me to help her, but what could I do? I called the police. I think a lot of people must have done the same.
There was a car, a blue Volkswagen, parked just a short way up the road. I noticed someone sitting in it, and then, seconds later, it pulled out from the curb and accelerated away. I swear it had smoke coming out of the exhaust, and I heard the sound of the rubber tyres screaming against the tarmac. Of course, at the time, I didn't know it belonged to the woman who was responsible for the accident, but I took down her number and reported it to the police. That was when I noticed the man that I'd been serving. He suddenly turned round and walked away. He went round the corner into King Street, and then he disappeared.
Did that strike you as strange?
Hawthorne asked. It most certainly did. He was behaving in a very peculiar way. I mean, what do you do when you see an accident like that? You either stay and you watch, that's human nature, or you decide it's got nothing to do with you and you leave. But he hurried away, like he didn't want to be seen. And here's the point. He'd seen it. He must have. It had happened right in front of him. But when the police asked for witness statements, he never came forward.
What else can you tell us about him?
Not a lot. Because that's the other thing. He was wearing sunglasses. Now, why would he do that? It was 4:30 in the afternoon and the sun was low in the sky. In fact, it was getting a little cloudy. He didn't need them, unless he was someone famous and didn't want to be recognised. I can't remember much else about him, to be honest. He was also wearing a cap. But I can tell you what he bought.
And what was that?
A jar of honey and a packet of ginger tea. It was local honey from a place in Finglesham. I recommended it.
So what happened next?
Traverton sighed. There's not very much more to tell you. The nanny was kneeling there. At least one of the children was alive. I saw him open his eyes. He called out for his father. Daddy. It was pitiful, really, it was. Then the police and the ambulance arrived. It hadn't taken them very long to get there. I went back into the shop. Actually, I went upstairs and had a cup of tea. I wasn't feeling at all well. I don't feel that good now, remembering it all. I understand the woman in the car has been killed. Is that why you're here? That's a terrible thing. But I won't say she deserved it. But driving away like that? All the harm she caused? I think the judge let her off far too lightly. And I'm not at all surprised that someone else agreed. From the pharmacy, we walked the short distance to the Royal Hotel. Hawthorne said nothing. He had a son himself, of course, an 11-year-old. He was just 3 years older than Timothy Godwin had been when he died, and it was possible that the story we had just heard had made an impression on Hawthorne. But I have to say that he didn't look particularly sad. If anything, he seemed to be in a hurry to be on his way. We entered the sort of lounge you can only get in an English seaside hotel. Low ceilings, wooden floors with scattered rugs, and cosy leather furniture. It was surprisingly crowded, mainly with elderly couples tucking into sandwiches and beer. The room was almost unbearably warm, with radiators on full blast and a gas-effect fire to one side. We made our way through to the reception area. The friendly local girl who was working there said she couldn't help us, but telephoned the manager, who came up from the downstairs bar. Her name was Mrs. Rendell, like the crime writer, she said. She had been at the Royal Hotel for 12 years, but hadn't been working on the day of the accident. She had, however, met Mary O'Brien and the two children.
They were dear little things, very well behaved. They had the family room on the second floor. It has a king-sized bed and bunks. Would you like to see it?
Not really, Hawthorne said.
Oh.
He had offended her, but she continued anyway.
They came down on a Wednesday, and the accident happened the next day. As a matter of fact, Miss O'Brien wasn't happy with the room. It doesn't have sea views. She'd requested a twin and a double with an adjoining door, but we don't have such a thing in this hotel, and we couldn't allow two small children to sleep on their own.
Mrs. Rendell was a small, thin woman. She had the sort of face that finds it easy to express indignation.
I can't say I terribly liked her, she remarked. I didn't trust her, and, although I hate to have to say it, I was right. She should have been holding on to the two boys. Instead, she allowed them to run across the road, and that was what killed them. I really don't think Mrs. Cooper was to blame for the accident.
Did you know her?
Of course I knew her. She often came into the hotel for lunch or for dinner. She was charming, and she had a famous son. Deal is quite well known for its celebrities. Lord Nelson and Lady Hamilton are the best known, but Norman Wisdom also came here. And Charles Hawtrey used to like sitting at the bar. He moved to Deal after he retired.
Charles Hawtrey. I still remembered him, the skinny actor with dark wavy hair and round glasses. He was the gay, friendless, drunken star of the Carry On films, British humour at its most dysfunctional. I had watched him in black and white films when I was 9 years old, at boarding school. They used to screen them in the gymnasium. Carry On Nurse, Carry On Teacher, Carry On Constable. It was the one big treat of the week, a break from the beatings, bad food and bullying that made up the rest of my time there. For some children, growing up begins the moment they discover that Santa Claus doesn't exist. For me, it was realising Charles Hawtrey wasn't and never had been funny. And he had sat here, in this hotel, sipping his gin and watching the boys go by. Suddenly, I didn't want to be here either. And I was glad when Hawthorne thanked the woman and said he had no more questions, and the two of us left. 19. Mr. Tibbs. I wasn't expecting to see Hawthorne the next day, so I was surprised to get a telephone call from him shortly after breakfast.
You doing anything this evening?
I'm working, I said.
I need to come round.
Here?
Yes.
Why? Hawthorne had never been to my London flat before, and I was happy to keep it that way. I was the one trying to insinuate myself into his life, not the other way round. And so far, he hadn't even told me his address. In fact, he had deliberately misled me. He had said his home was in Gants Hill, when he actually had a flat in River Court, Blackfriars, on the other side of the river. I didn't like the idea of him casting his detective's eye over my home, my possessions, and perhaps coming to conclusions that he might later use against me. He must have sensed the hesitation at the other end of the line.
I need to set up a meeting, he explained. I want it to be somewhere neutral.
What's wrong with your place?
That wouldn't be appropriate. He paused. I've worked out what really happened in Deal, he said. I think you'll agree that it's relevant to our investigation.
Who are you meeting?
You'll know who they both are when they get here.
He tried one last plea.
It's important.
As it happened, I was on my own that evening, and it occurred to me that if I allowed Hawthorne to see where I lived, perhaps I might be able to persuade him to do the same. I was still keen to find out how he could possibly afford a flat overlooking the river, and although Meadows had said he didn't own it, I was curious to see inside. What time? I asked.
5 o'clock.
All right, I said, already regretting it. You can come here for an hour, but that's it.
That's great.
He rang off. I spent the rest of the morning typing up my notes from the investigation so far. Britannia Road, Cornwallis and Sons, the South Acton Estate. I had made several hours' worth of recordings on my iPhone, and I connected it to my computer, listening to Hawthorne's flat, wheedling voice through a set of headphones. I'd also taken dozens of photographs, and I flicked through them, reminding myself of what I'd seen. I already had far more material than I needed, and I was sure that 90% of it was irrelevant. For example, Andrea Kluvanek had talked at length about her childhood in the Banská Štiavnica district of Slovakia and how happy she had been until the death of her father in an agricultural accident. But even as she had gone on, I'd been doubtful that any of it would make the first draft. I'd never worked this way before. Normally, when I'm planning a novel or a TV script, I know exactly what I need and don't waste time with extraneous details. But without knowing what was going on inside Hawthorne's head, how could I tell what was relevant and what wasn't? It was exactly what he had warned me about when he'd read my first chapter. A spring bell mechanism on a door, or its absence, could make all the difference to the conclusion, and leaving something out could be just as damaging as making it up. As a result, I was having to write down everything I saw in every room I visited, whether it was the Stieg Larsson in Diana Cooper's bedroom, the fish-shaped key hook in her kitchen, or the post-it notes in Judith Godwin's kitchen. And the rapidly growing pile of information was driving me mad. I was still convinced that Alan Godwin was the killer. If it wasn't him, who else could it have been? That was the question I asked myself as I sat at my desk, surrounded by what felt like a devastation of white A4. Well, there was Judith Godwin, for one. She had exactly the same motivation. I thought back to what Hawthorne had said about the killer when we were at the scene of the crime, then rifled through the pages until I found it. He was almost certainly a man. I've heard of women strangling women, but take it from me, it's unusual. Those were his exact words, recorded and written down. As a result, I hadn't considered any of the women I had met, but almost certainly was not 100% definite, and unusual was not impossible. It could have been Judith. It could have been Mary O'Brien, so devoted to the family that she had stayed working with them for the whole 10 years. And what about Jeremy Godwin? It was always possible that he wasn't quite as helpless as everyone supposed. And then there was Grace Lavelle, the actress who had moved in with Damien Cooper. Although she hadn't said so in as many words, there was clearly no love lost between her and Damien's mother, whose interest had extended no further than her first grandchild, Ashley. The baby had been the end of Grace's acting career, and if the newspaper stories were true, Damien had proved to be a far from ideal partner. Drugs, parties, showgirls, it easily added up to a motive for murder. On the other hand, she had been in America when Diana was killed. Or had she? Once again, I scoured through my notes and found exactly what I was looking for. A line spoken by Damien Cooper that hadn't registered at the time, but which, I now saw, was hugely significant. Grace had complained that she didn't want to go back to Los Angeles. She wanted to spend more time with her parents, and Damien had said to her, "You've already had a week with them, babe." I felt a glow of satisfaction. I really had missed nothing. It might even be that I was ahead of Hawthorne on this one. A week might be an approximation. Grace could have arrived 9 or 10 days ahead of Damien, in which case she could easily have been in the country on the day that Diana was killed. That said, we had left her behind at the pub in the Fulham Road after the funeral, and remembering how heavy the traffic was, I would have thought it impossible for her to have reached Brick Lane before us. Who else was there? I had spent a lot of time with Robert Cornwallis, and for that matter with his cousin, Irene Laws. Either of them could have slipped the music player into the coffin, but why would they have? They only met Diana Cooper on the day she died. Neither of them had anything to gain from her death, or that of her son. I spent the rest of the day working on my notes, and hardly noticed the time when, at 4:45, the doorbell rang. I work on the 5th floor of the building, with an intercom that connects me to the street, although there are times when I don't feel connected at all, stuck in my ivory tower. I buzzed the door open, then went downstairs to meet my guest.
"Nice place," Hawthorne said as he walked in. "But I don't think we'll need the drinks."
I'd laid out glasses with a choice of mineral water and orange juice, as it seemed a polite thing to do. I noticed him examining the living room as I returned them to the fridge. The main floor of my flat is essentially one large space. It has bookshelves. I have about 500 books in the house, but I keep my favourite ones here. A kitchen area, a dining room table, and my mother's old piano, which I try to play every day. There's a TV area and a couple of sofas around a coffee table. Hawthorne sat down here. He looked completely relaxed. "So you know what really happened in Deal," I said. "Am I about to find out who killed Diana Cooper?" Hawthorne shook his head.
"Not right now. But I think you'll find it interesting. I've got some good news, by the way," he added.
"What's that?"
"Mr. Tibbs has turned up."
"Mr. Tibbs?" It took me a few seconds to remember who he was. "The cat?"
"Diana Cooper's Persian grey."
"Where was he?"
"He'd got into the neighbour's house through a skylight. Then he couldn't get out again. He was found by the owners when they got back from the south of France and they called me."
"I suppose that is good news," I said, wondering what Diana Cooper's cat had to do with anything. Then another thought struck me. "Wait a minute, there was a lawyer living in the house next door."
"Mr. Grossman."
"Why did he contact you? How did he even know who you were?"
"I put a note through his door. Actually, I put a note in all the houses in Britannia Road. I wanted to know if the cat had made an appearance."
"Why?"
"Mr. Tibbs is the reason everything happened, Tony. If it hadn't been for him, Mrs. Cooper might never have been killed. And nor would her son."
I was sure he was joking. But he was sitting there with that strange energy of his, that mix of malice and single-mindedness that made him so hard to read. And before I could challenge him, the doorbell rang for a second time.
"Shall I answer it?" I asked.
Hawthorne waved a hand.
"It's your place."
I went over to the intercom and picked up the telephone. "Yes?"
"This is Alan Godwin."
I felt a surge of excitement. So that was my first visitor. I told him to come up the 3 flights of stairs and buzzed him in. He appeared a short while later, wearing a raincoat that looked a size too large for him, the same coat he had worn at the funeral. He came into the room like a man approaching the scaffold, and I was quite certain that, despite what he had said to me on the way to Canterbury, Hawthorne had summoned him here to accuse him of the murders, and that everything was about to be revealed to me. Then I remembered that there were 2 people coming. Could Godwin have had an accomplice? "What is it you want?" he asked, heading straight for Hawthorne. "You said there was something you had to tell me. Why couldn't you just do it over the phone?" He looked around him, noticing his surroundings for the first time. "Do you live here?"
"No." Hawthorne pointed in my direction. "He does."
Godwin realized that although we had met, he knew nothing about me. "Who are you?" he demanded. "You never told me your name." Fortunately, the doorbell rang again, and I'd hurried over to answer it. This time there was silence from the street. "Are you here to see Hawthorne?" I asked.
"Yes."
It was a woman's voice. "I'll open the door. Just follow the stairs up to the flat." "Who is that?" Godwin demanded, but from the fear in his voice, I think he knew.
"Why don't you sit down, Mr. Godwin?" Hawthorne said. "Although you won't believe me, I'm actually trying to help you. Is there anything you want?"
"I've got juice," I said. "I'll have some water." Godwin sat down on the other side of the table, facing Hawthorne, but carefully avoiding his eye. I went and got the water that Hawthorne had told me to put away. I just brought it over when I heard more footsteps and Mary O'Brien walked into the room. She was the last person I had expected to see, but at the same time it suddenly seemed obvious that it should have been her. She took 2 steps towards us, then stopped dead. If she had been nervous and uncertain a moment before, she was now simply thunderstruck. She had noticed Alan Godwin, and she was staring at him. He, equally shocked, stared back. Hawthorne sprang to his feet. There was something almost devilish about him, a glee I had never seen before.
"I think you 2 know each other," he said.
Alan Godwin was the first to recover. "Of course we know each other. What do you mean by this?"
"I think you know exactly what's going on, Alan. Why don't you sit down, Mary? I think I can call you that. We're all friends here."
"I don't understand."
Mary O'Brien was trying to keep her emotions in check, but she was on the edge of tears. She looked at Godwin.
"Why are you here?"
"He told me to come." The 2 of them looked guilty, angry, afraid. Godwin stood up. "I'm not staying here," he said. "I don't care what game you're playing, Mr. Hawthorne. I'm not having any of it."
"Well, that's fine, Alan. But you walk out this room, the police are going to know everything. And so is your wife."
Godwin froze. Mary also wasn't moving. Hawthorne was completely in charge.
"Sit down," he said. "You 2 have been colluding together in lie for 10 years. But it's over. That's why you're here."
Godwin sat down again. Mary joined him on the sofa, keeping a distance between them. As she took her place, I saw him mouth the words, "I'm sorry." And right then, I knew that the 2 of them were lovers and that Judith Godwin had suspected it too. That was the reason why there had been tension between the 2 women. I sat down on the piano stool. Hawthorne was the only one in the room who was still on his feet.
"We need to get to the bottom of what happened in Deal," he began. "Because I've heard this story 6 times, and I've even been to the bloody place, and it's never made any sense. That's not surprising. Everything you 2 have said has been a complete pack of lies. God knows what it must have been like for you, but the trouble is, you had no choice. You were locked into this, and there was no way out. I'd almost feel sorry for you. Except I don't."
He took out a packet of cigarettes and lit one. I went into the kitchen, found an ashtray, and put it on the table for him to use.
"When did you start your affair?" Hawthorne asked.
There was a long silence. Mary had begun to cry. Alan Godwin reached out to take her hand, but she pulled it away. Godwin must have known there was no point trying to pretend.
It was very soon after Mary started with us, he replied. I was the one who started it. I take full responsibility. It's over now, Mary said quietly. It's been over for a long time.
To be honest with you, I don't care about your relationship, Hawthorne said. I just want the facts. And the fact is that you were responsible for what happened in Deal. Both of you. Diana Cooper may have forgotten her specs, but those two little kids got run over because of you. And you know it. You've been living with it ever since.
Mary nodded. The tears ran down her cheeks. Hawthorne turned to me.
I'll be honest with you, Tony. When you and I were in Deal, there was lots of stuff I didn't understand. Where do I even start? The kids run across the street to an ice cream shop, only it's closed. Not only that, it's flooded and all the electrics are bust. It's dark. I know there were only eight, but they must have seen there was no chance they were going to get a Mr. Whippy there. And then they get hit by the car, and one of them is dead and the other's lying there. And according to Mr. Traverton in the chemist shop, he's calling out for his daddy. But no child does that. When a child gets hurt, what he wants is his mummy. So what's going on there?
He paused for a moment. Nobody spoke, and it struck me that he was completely in control of the situation, that this might as well have been his flat as mine. Hawthorne certainly had a magnetic personality, although, of course, magnets can repel as well as attract.
Let's go back to the beginning, he went on. Mary here takes the boys to Deal. Mum has a conference. Dad's on a business trip to Manchester. She books into the Royal Hotel, but she doesn't want a family room. She wants a twin room for the kids and a double room next door. Why do you think that is?
The hotel said that the family room didn't have a sea view, I said.
It didn't have anything to do with the view. Why don't you tell him, Mary?
Mary didn't look at me. When she spoke, her voice was almost robotic.
We were meeting in Deal. We were going to be together.
That's right. The nanny and her boss, having it off together. But you can't do it in Harrow on the Hill, not in the family home, so you steal a weekend on the coast. The boys go to bed at 6 o'clock, which leaves the whole night for you to be together.
You're disgusting, Godwin said. You make it sound so sordid.
And it wasn't. Hawthorne blew out smoke. You were the mysterious man in the chemist shop. And what were you doing in there? Wasn't to get a pack of six. The reason you were in there was the same reason you were crying your eyes out at Diana Cooper's funeral.
I had wondered why he'd been so upset.
It was hay fever, Hawthorne explained.
Once again, he addressed himself to me.
When we were in Brompton Cemetery, did you notice the plane trees?
Yes, I said. I made a note. They were right next to the grave.
Plane trees are the worst if you get hay fever. They've got a pollen grain that gets right up your nose. And shall I tell you two well-known cures for hay fever?
Honey, I said, and ginger tea.
And that's exactly what Alan was buying in Pier Pharmacy.
He turned back to Godwin.
It's also the reason why you were wearing sunglasses, even though it wasn't sunny. You'd gone down to Deal to meet your girlfriend. But then you got an attack of hay fever, so you went into the chemist to get something to help. Traverton gave you some herbal stuff, and you left the place seconds before the accident took place. And it was you who caused the accident. The two kids were on the promenade next to the beach. They'd been told never to run across the road, and anyway, they could see perfectly well that the ice cream shop was closed. But suddenly, in front of their eyes, their dad walked out of the chemist shop next door. And even with the cap and the sunglasses, they recognised you. And because they were excited, they ran towards you. That was the moment when Diana Cooper turned the corner, and it happened right in front of your eyes. Both your children were hit.
Godwin groaned and put his head in his hands. Beside him, Mary sobbed quietly.
Timothy was killed. Jeremy was lying there. And of course he called out for his dad, because he'd seen him just a moment ago. I can't imagine what you must have been feeling right then, Alan. You'd just seen your two children knocked over by a car, but you couldn't go to them because you were supposed to be in Manchester. How were you going to explain to your wife that you were actually in Deal?
I didn't realise they were so badly hurt, Godwin rasped. There was nothing I could have done to help.
You know what? I think that's bollocks. I think you could have run into